Hey guys, I'm about to bring you my conversation with Bill Kristol about how swing voters are thinking about the choice between Trump and Biden on foreign policy. Now, we taped this show before Iran launched its attack on Israel on April 13th and 14th. And so while it deals with foreign policy, it actually focuses more on NATO and America's role in the post-Cold War era, so more Russia, Ukraine, rather than the Middle East. This show still totally holds up, but just wanted to get that caveat at the top. So, without further ado, my conversation with Bill Kristol. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Focus Group podcast. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and this week we're talking about foreign policy. But don't turn it off. Don't say, oh, no, I want to skip anything foreign policy related. Because one unique feature of this Biden-Trump election is that voters have gotten to see both candidates operate as president, including representing America on the world stage. And for whoever wins this election, the conflicts in Ukraine and in the Middle East will be defining parts of the next 4 years. So we wanted to see how swing voters are grappling with Joe Biden's and Donald Trump's records on foreign policy. Obviously, Biden fumbled our withdrawal from Afghanistan, but unlike Trump, he's never had a kind word to say about Vladimir Putin. So we're going to explore that tension a little further today. My guest is Bill Kristol, an unrepentant neocon and co-author of the Bulwark's Morning Shots newsletter with Andrew Egger and my good friend. Hey, Bill, thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Sarah. Great to talk about foreign policy, which I think people are more interested in than conventional wisdom has it, I hope.
It's not even conventional wisdom. It's like JVL. This is like JVL is always like, no one cares about foreign policy. But whether or not is the kind of thing that people are excited to talk about, the fact is it is going to be just like, look, people don't love picking through like the this and that's of all the legal troubles either. But like these are important issues for this election. The foreign policy is enormously important right now. But why don't you level set for us? So what are the stakes of this election specifically as it relates to foreign policy?
Ukraine, NATO, Putin, that constellation of issues is in a class by itself. You could argue about other things. Israel, it's a little murky how they would differ. Afghanistan, Trump wanted to get out. Biden did get out, didn't do it very well, but Trump wouldn't have done it any better, perhaps. China policy, they're both pretty hawkish now. Trump's a little more belligerent in tone, but then turns out to kind of like Xi Jinping too. So I do feel like this is a rare case, really, in modern American politics, where they're pretty much 180 degrees apart on Ukraine/NATO/Putin, which is the largest land war in Europe in 80 years. And everyone serious seems to think, and I agree with them, this is a sort of a defining moment, inflection point for the post-Cold War world. And so I think there's got to be some chunk of voters who like a Republican-ish attitude towards foreign policy, Reagan, Bush, McCain, but Biden's closer on Ukraine, especially, to that attitude. And a fair chunk of Republicans have been there in Congress, obviously, half of them or so, supporting a sort of hawkish stand against Putin. And so it's a chance not to get ahead of ourselves. We'll see what the voters say here. But, you know, I do think politically, if you think about who are the swing voters, what issues might they be cross-pressured on? What might move them one way or the other? I've got to think being a Republican who doesn't like Biden for all kinds of reasons, but is a Reagan Republican on foreign policy, that's a pretty big gulf to cross to then support Trump. And maybe they could be won over by Biden despite some resistance, some reluctance.
We will get into that. But first, I want to listen to how our most recent group of Trump to Biden voters talked about both of these men, Trump and Biden, on foreign policy. So we level set this conversation by telling the voters that they'd each gotten to see a full term of Trump and close to a full term of Biden. And then we asked them to make a direct comparison. So let's first listen to what they had to say about Joe Biden.
He's got a lot more experience with foreign policy. He probably has a lot more experience dealing with the players in foreign countries, too. He doesn't really seem to have anything unique. So I'd say he's like, you know, overall, I think he's better than Trump, but he's nothing, you know, he's not outstanding. It doesn't seem like he initiates. He's not like a go-getter.
How Biden, he visits more countries. He's out there. He's present. He's meeting with the other leaders. Yet, then I also see him as sometimes indecisive.
I mean, he went to Ukraine and rode the train during the middle of the war. He's been on the world stage. He went to Israel after the attack. I mean, he's been very out there, I mean, especially for his age, too. Biden got back some of the people that were being held hostage in Russia, which, you know, in other countries, I mean, he's still working on it. And, you know, he actually was a pretty big role in getting some of the Israeli hostages back. I think he's been a wheeler and a dealer more so than any other president.
With Biden, I think he has enough good people around him to do the right thing. I don't know if he's as stern as he should be, but I think recently with Israel, I think he was pretty stern. But I'd have to say he did a better job than what Trump did.
As for Biden, I mean, like, he's out there and he's visiting other countries, but he does have better relationships, I think, with who he's visiting. And I'm more comfortable with having him represent us than I was with Trump.
His heart's in the right place, and I think he wants to do the right thing or things that are good for other countries and countries that need us. But I kind of feel like America's no longer thought of as one of the most powerful countries. Like, it takes a while. They don't just listen to us automatically anymore. They're kind of, maybe, you know, like, it just now seemed like he got a little strong with Israel.
Definitely with Joe, some mistakes, you know, the Afghanistan stuff, and now war is almost everywhere you're looking, which is just putting everyone at unease.
Okay, so sort of a consensus in this group, both that Joe Biden was sort of better than Trump. There's one big Biden stan in this group. You're going to hear her throughout this episode. There's just one woman who just argued aggressively for Biden the whole time. I think everybody else, though, the consensus was, and I hear this a lot in the swing voting groups, like, where is Joe Biden? And I've always worried that the way that he handles foreign policy sometimes looks a little bit more like a bystander than somebody who is, like, taking the lead or in control. So, like, how does Biden project strength in this moment? Because it seems like one of the bigger opportunities for him to project strength.
Yeah, so these are Trump-Biden voters, right? 2016 Trump, 2020 Biden.
That's right. As we affectionately call them, flippers. But yes, Trump to Biden.
And so it's interesting to me, and you've seen zillions of these, and I want you should comment on this. My feeling is they're pretty much sticking with Biden on foreign policy. And that wouldn't be true on every issue, would it? On the border, on inflation, they might be more, Biden really let me down. But it feels to me like overall, they give Biden a passing grade in foreign policy, which maybe that's one of Biden's better issues by contrast with Trump, since these are flippers.
So I agree with that. I think, look, you know, we obviously have over on our advocacy side of things, we've got our Republicans for Ukraine project, which you're also involved in because we're friends and do a lot of things together. But, like, look, there's no bigger shift that I have seen in this Republican Party than on foreign policy in terms of it moving away from its interest in American leadership in the world. However, the people for whom their Republican identity still mattered a great deal, how we were on the world stage and how we dealt on foreign policy, they want to help Ukraine. And they are recognizing, I think, that the party is moving away from them through the prism of foreign policy. They're like, wait a minute, as Republicans, we're supposed to be the ones who want to take a stand on this. And I think it's not all Republicans for whom this is a big issue. In fact, it's probably a much narrower slice, but the ones for whom it is, this is one of those things that I think helped them identify more with Biden than with Trump.
And the criticism we've heard, if you admire Reagan, if you admire George W. Bush, if you admire McCain, you want a little more toughness, a little more repetition of the kind of principles of our foreign policy, maybe of criticizing domestic opponents for not going along with Speaker Johnson on Ukraine aid. Biden, I think, he is, and he's older, and he's a Democrat, so he's got a more modulated approach, for better or worse, does a lot of stuff behind the scenes, some of it pretty effective, I think, doesn't really rally the American people as much as he could, and I think that's probably a mistake. These are the kinds of objections to Biden that you would expect to hear, don't you think, from Bush and McCain, Romney voters, but they're not deal breakers, right? Whereas I do think on some of these other issues, they might be sufficient. You know, there seem to be some people who objected so much to Biden that they're drifting back towards Trump or can't vote for Biden again.
I feel Biden's absence on this. I think that real clear articulations of what America stands for and who we're going to be as an ally on the world stage is the kind of thing that feels like the moment cries out for more of those. And when I get on Biden, as I do, I think, on this podcast a fair amount, in large part because I hear it from the voters, the kind of, like, where is he? You know, why isn't he taking more of a leadership role? And you hear it all through these statements. It just seems like such an obvious opportunity. Then this is one where I'm often making the case for surrogates to go out there and, like, they can go tell the story about the infrastructure deal, you know? But nobody can do what Biden can do as president of the United States to be like, I'm the one in control here. And you can feel confident that I am in control here. Forget campaigning. Like, he would do more for himself, just not even campaigning, but just like being the president and showing people that he is handling these things because people feel uneasy. You know, one of the things that's funny I hear in these groups all the time, well, we weren't in a war when Donald Trump was president. Now we're in all these wars. And you're like, actually, we were in a war when Donald Trump was president, and now we're not in a war. However, what they mean is that the world feels chaotic and like people had adjusted to Afghanistan just being in a sort of a forever war there. And so they want somebody who's saying, here's how we're going to deal with this. Here's our plan. And just watching, I think, the chaos unfold and it seeming like we're taking a back seat, I think frustrates these types of voters.
I agree. And I think it also means he doesn't quite rally as much support as he could.
Yeah.
On some of these issues. I mean, the conventionalism is so much, it's bread and butter issues. You've got to go visit a new plant that's being started here or some happy workers over there. And I don't minimize any of that. But I think he's missed some chances to really highlight foreign policy and to highlight his own leadership and to be outspoken on it. He started off the State of the Union with Ukraine. It was a very strong start, I thought.
Yes.
But since then, he hasn't really spoke about it that much. And I very much agree with you. He doesn't need to go traipsing around the country to giving speeches to random, you know, Council of Foreign Relations of Omaha. A lot of that could be done from the Oval Office, just the meetings with foreign leaders, 5 minutes with the two of them seated there in those chairs. Every American's familiar with that image. And have a strong statement that you make, have the foreign leader say something nice about you. Does it move huge numbers of voters? No. But is it? It's a real thing. People expect that of a president. A lot of people were nervous when Trump would have these meetings. God knows what would happen. I do think I was thinking about this just a minute ago, though, about foreign policy. So we do have, I guess we'll have the 80th anniversary of D-Day on June 4th. Reagan famously went 40 years ago. It's a tough act to follow. On the other hand, that would be a moment. The NATO summit, 75th anniversary of NATO, is in Washington in July. Again, NATO summits, this is a total zoo of foreign leaders and motorcades and meetings and boring communiques, and maybe it ends up being nothing. But it's given that NATO is kind of central to our strategy and central to Ukraine and central to the case for Ukraine. And it's our allies against Putin. And given where Trump is on NATO, I think Biden could highlight that. So I think, as you say, he doesn't have to do campaign events, but by being president, but highlighting certain aspects of his presidency and foreign policy over the next 2-3 months, I think he could set himself up to remind a fair number of McCain-Romney voters why they should stick with Biden.
And I think in addition, I'll just throw this last thing in. You know, part of who Biden needs, I think, is some of the generals who worked for Trump, right? It's like your Mattises, your Kellys, who were just absolutely appalled by what they saw out of Trump on the world stage. And I think Biden exercising as president, his sort of just prerogatives as president of meeting with world leaders and showing that he's going to be in charge, taking things in hand, I think is the kind of thing that makes those generals who are so worried about Trump pulling us out of NATO and doing some of these other crazy things, letting Putin have his way with Ukraine, could push them from just right now where they say, like, absolutely, I'm not going to vote for Trump, to being more affirmatively for Biden. He needs those voices on his side.
And my sense is he hasn't done much outreach to them. I mean, has there been a photo of him and Mitt Romney just having lunch in the White House just to talk about foreign policy primarily? You know, he's a Republican, I'm a Democrat, but on foreign policy, we're in sync in some ways. And I've talked to Mitt and got his counsel. I would be crazy to appoint some of these people to even some kind of symbolic roles. Romney or Kinzinger is also a foreign policy focused guy. Liz Cheney, having them in to talk about substance, and probably foreign policy is the easiest substance for Biden to talk to Nikki Haley or Liz Cheney or Mitt Romney about, or former Defense Secretary Mark Esper, people who aren't that well known. And just say, I wanted to pick the brains of the people who served in this office in both parties. And I feel like he misses a bit of an opportunity to do more on the foreign policy side.
Agree. I want to turn to how these voters talked about Trump on foreign policy. Let's listen.
Okay. I think Trump, for newbie, I agreed with a lot of his foreign policy, except that the one area where I didn't agree with him was the way he outwardly dissed our NATO members. I think that was very bad. But I liked what he was doing with China. I liked sort of what he was doing with Russia.
I thought he was like an embarrassment on the world stage. I think he kissed up to the dictators like Kim Jong-un. I mean, what is Kim Jong-un going to go do for America? What is Putin doing for America?
Yes, starting with Trump, I felt he had some good policies, that he did some good things, but the president of the United States is someone that represents the United States to other countries. If you look at even residents of other countries, the only person in politics that they're going to know in the U.S. is usually the president. And his antics, in my eyes, embarrassed me as an American with the way that he handled things, the way that he talked to people, the way that he bullied people.
With Trump, at least, I think he tried to make some strides towards bettering relationships with some countries that we didn't historically have good relationships with. I liked that he was trying to improve things there. But also at the same time, he can be kind of embarrassing to the rest of the country. Like, is this the man that we want representing us to other countries?
I think that Trump had some good policies, his execution as a person and a representative of the country is a little bit to be desired. But I also would add that I think Biden on the world stage is very frail. I think he stumbles. And I think that projects a weakness that perhaps if his policies are good, I think that the projection he gives detracts from that, just the way people see him.
I'm saying as far as Trump goes, you know, I think he had a couple of ideas that might be good, might work, but his overall obsession with Putin and his glorification of him is just too frightening to me.
So because these are flippers, they voted for Trump once and then they voted for Biden, they tend to be Republicans at their core, right? They're right-leaning independents, soft GOP voters. One of the things that's so interesting to me is how they're not mostly talking about policy when it comes to foreign policy. They're talking about how they project on the world stage, like what they seem like. And so for Trump, he's a big bully and embarrassing, and they remember being embarrassed by him on the world stage, which I heard all the time back then from voters that we thought were gettable, people who'd voted for Trump but rated him as doing a very bad job. They brought up that he was embarrassing them on the world stage all the time. But I also hear from swing voters now that they feel like Biden's embarrassing on the world stage because he's just older. And so it comes down to this idea of like, I want somebody that projects American strength, and I want a vision of American strength, but also American seriousness. So remind our audience, because the Helsinki summit, where Trump took the word of Putin over American intelligence agencies, what were some of the foreign policy lowlights of the Trump years? Like, what do you remember? Like, does it seem like voters have memory hold those? Or do you think that they had an appropriate sense of how crazy it was?
I don't know. I mean, I think people who are, you know, been in government, people who've served in the military and the State Department and stuff, had a little more of a granular sense of just how close things came to blowing apart under Trump. And I do think our NATO allies spent a lot of time figuring out, to their credit, really, how to keep it together for 4 years. People in the administration, McMaster, Mattis, Mark Esper, a ton of them, spent a lot of time stopping Trump from doing certain things or guiding him to do a less drastic version of certain things. I mean, one point that has to be made, and I think this is a campaign point for Biden to make, is a Trump second term would be much more dangerous than a Trump first term. There's not going to be H.R. McMaster and Jim Mattis. There's not even going to be Mike Pence. I mean, we know the kinds of people who'll be in there. They're the kinds of people who Trump tried to put in at the end of the first term after Election Day, before January 6th. And they are all in on America First. And America First really is dangerous and really would, you know, dissolve the post-Cold War order and the post-World War II order. And that would, the world's gotten more dangerous anyway. I mean, this is where Biden gets hurt a little bit. He doesn't get to say total peace and happiness under me, chaos under Trump. He gets to say chaos under Trump, I've done my best to deal with real challenges, and we are in a more dangerous world. I think he could be candid about that. I actually think Biden would actually be helped. I was talking to someone, a foreign policy guy who does a lot of work for the government, actually, yesterday, that there's no articulation of, we are not going back to happy days and tranquility in foreign policy. We've got Putin, we've got real serious China challenge, we have other nations, Iran, North Korea, they're unfortunately working together. Laying that out for people, but saying, but therefore we need grown-up leadership, serious leadership, and then getting other people to testify to Biden's serious leadership, and then getting people to disqualify Trump, people who worked with Trump, as you said. It's so unusual that you have the most recent president and the current president, right? I mean, normally you have the challenger and the president. The challenger, they're not sure about. Is he up to it? How would he do? You know, this is totally different. They're two presidents they've seen every day for 4 years in one case and 3+ years in another. Biden has some deficiencies, and some people like certain aspects of Trump looking like a tough guy. But I think Biden really needs actually a sustained strategy almost to both explain to people the world he's dealing with. I think that one person who said, you know, it's chaos out there, it's more dangerous than ever. And I think Biden needs to kind of acknowledge that. It can't just be, don't worry, we've got everything under control. It's, you know what? We have real challenges over the next bunch of years, but I'm confident America can meet them, and here's how we're doing it. And then get other people to testify, A, that Biden is doing it adequately or well, and B, that you can't trust Trump. I think they really need to make people scared of what a Trump second term would be, precisely because the world is more chaotic. I mean, in a weird way, the chaos is an opportunity for Biden, right? Trump could afford to be goofing around and all this before February 24th, 2022, before October 7th, 2023. And now we can't afford that.
Yeah, the idea of saying Trump is unserious about the world. Like, he says things like Putin can just do what he wants with Europe and that he would break apart our NATO alliance. That, I think, though, gives Biden an opportunity to like be the president in a high profile way and do things that make people feel increasingly like actually he's just doing a fine job as Trump sort of comes in as a chaos agent. Although this is like one of those things on foreign policy I feel obligated to mention, because I hear it all the time in the Trump focus groups where they think his chaos nature is his asset. They always say this, that, well, none of this would have happened with Trump because they never know what Trump's going to do because he's such a wild man. And so they can't predict what he's going to do. And therefore, you know, these world leaders don't mess with him. I think that is bonkers psychology, because it's basically like, you never know what the psycho with his hand on the button is going to do. Seems like a bad way to run a nuclear power. I don't know. That's just me. But I do think there's a lot that you can weave in here too. I mean, the documents, right? The documents that he's holding with our actual nuclear secrets on them that he's just casually showing around to me. Like, this is an irresponsible person who should not be in charge during this dangerous time. So I want to talk, though, about how these flippers thought about Russia. But first, it's worth walking through how Republicans have evolved on Russia and Ukraine. In March 2022, Republicans talked about what a big threat Putin was and the need to be tough on him. They were even cheering on the Ukrainian babushkas. Remember this with the AK-47s? And we're going to link to my show with Alexander Vindman in the show notes, because he and I did a whole episode on this. A year later, voters talked about how corrupt Ukraine was and how we needed to be focused on our problems at home. And I'll link to my show with Tom Nichols about that one. But in our recent catch up with swing voters, they seemed like they saw the threat of Russia and Putin pretty clearly. Let's listen.
I am afraid that if the Ukraine can't stop him, he'll just keep going. He'll take over maybe another country and another one, and who knows where it'll stop, because he doesn't know how to stop. So we maybe need to do a little more than what we're doing now. They're fighting so hard, and you have to feel, you know, badly for a country that's trying so hard to beat such a powerful country like Russia.
And I know that Russia is, you know, one of the top few countries in the world that has verifiable weapons of mass destruction, nuclear bombs and everything, and that go, you know, intercontinental. And, you know, they are also working on an EMP weapon that can come down from a satellite that would knock out the electronic grid and GPS. That would be a disaster for any type of defense worldwide. And I just don't trust Putin even more than I don't trust Trump. So, yes, we have to help Ukraine. We have to do it. We don't like to. We don't want to give them more money. But what are the alternatives?
Just like Nikki Haley had said, if we allow Putin to take over Ukraine, then he's going to go into Poland or one of some of the other countries where we're a member of NATO. And then we do have to put boots on the ground, and then we will be at war. So my thing is, we need to provide the weapons to Ukraine so they can win this war, because they're fighting it. And then hopefully that'll be the end of it. But if we don't help them and then they go into Poland or one of the other countries, then we will be boots on the ground and have to get involved.
Putin is just trouble waiting to happen. That's beyond the trouble he's already created. And we just can't give in to him. And we can't watch him just take over Ukraine like he's trying to do. And being the power that the United States are, even though we're not directly involved with troops, I mean, we have to stand up for the little guy around the world that's being bullied by somebody else. I mean, that's That's our responsibility as a country, is we can't watch somebody else and just stand by the wayside while they get bullied or taken over or beat up. You know, I think it's our responsibility morally to look out for those people if they can't look out for themselves entirely.
Okay. Now, a September 2023 survey from the Chicago Council for Global Affairs found that Americans thought the U.S. military support for Ukraine was worth the cost by a 53-45 margin. And that 53% included 69% of Democrats, 51% of independents, and 38% of Republicans. All right. So like I mentioned, Bill, you and I run a whole campaign in our advocacy work called Republicans for Ukraine, focused on amplifying the voices of Republican voters like the ones we just heard. But how worried are you about the pro-Ukraine wing of the GOP and beyond shrinking if Trump wins? Like, it's already shrinking now in the party. What do we do if the Republican Party is just no longer committed to defending democracies abroad?
I mean, it's terrible for the country. It's terrible for the world. It's already bad that he's the nominee. And if you talk to people from Europe, they already have to start hedging and calculating. He's the nominee of one of our two major parties. You know, a year ago, he might be the nominee, but maybe it'll be DeSantis, who waffled a bit on Ukraine, but was much better than Trump, obviously. Maybe it could be Nikki Haley or Tim Scott or Mike Pence or Chris Christie, all of whom were on the other side on Ukraine. And so world leaders already are having to deal with the fact that Trump is in charge of one of our two major parties. He's going to get more in charge over the next few months, obviously, and then he could win. So there's real damage being done to American foreign policy right now in real time, in my view, because Donald Trump is the nominee. And of course, the damage that would be done if he were to win is greater. The damage that will be done in October if he's running 3 points ahead, as foreign leaders start to calculate, including Putin, incidentally. I mean, one other thing I was struck by talking to these Europeans is they're very worried about the disinformation stuff from Putin and elsewhere, from China too, conceivably. And so people just aren't focused enough maybe on sort of all those aspects out there, that, you know, the ways in which Trump could be helped by others. It's happened before in 2016. You know, I was struck on one of the people in the focus group mentioned Nikki Haley, I think, right? I think that Nikki Haley found, as she campaigned, that foreign policy was a surprisingly strong issue for her, and that voters actually cared about it. Her voters cared about it.
Yeah.
20%, 25%, 30% of the GOP, granted, and some of them were Democrats, whatever, but still, it's not nobody. You know, she'd get 4 million votes, and she's still getting 15% of the votes in states where she's not competing, where it's over. But if half of them or two-thirds of them go away from Trump, that makes a big difference, right? I mean, she was very strong on this. As for Pence and Christie, I feel like Biden needs to make this a national kind of crusade, as it were, to save the West, to save NATO, to save Ukraine, to defeat Putin, and quote those people more. I mean, Biden is doing his thing, and he's doing pretty well, I would say. Why didn't he quote Nikki Haley in the State of the Union? It would have been kind of dramatic, you know? And I think some voters out there would have said, yeah, you know, that's right. He could talk a lot about the bipartisan tradition. He could make a joke about how he opposed Reagan so much. But in this respect, he feels like he's in Reagan's footsteps. He can make a joke about McCain, whom he was personally close to. I mean, I feel like the Biden people need to take advantage of that war. And then conversely, they need to disqualify Trump. And there, I don't know, what do you think? I feel like the people who worked in the Trump administration on foreign policy, who saved Trump, should not be president again. That's a pretty big statement. The Mike Pences and the John Boltons and Christie.
Yeah.
We'll see about Haley, but could well be Haley. And she was ambassador to the UN. Mark Esper. I don't think they need to be famous already, incidentally. You can make Mark Esper famous enough among 5% of Republican voters as Trump's Secretary of Defense, who is a sober, serious guy, served in the military. Then he's a very respected, very sort of workmanlike Secretary of Defense. He's voted for every Republican, I'm guessing, including Trump, I think, through 2016, maybe 2020, who knows. And now he says he can't vote for Trump. That should be more of a factor somehow, it feels to me like.
I do feel like I'm taking crazy pills sometimes when Mike Pence announces that he's not going to support Donald Trump. When was a vice president who just served with the guy, says, no, I'm not going to endorse him. I'm not, you know, basically, I think he's done some catastrophic things. The fact that that is like a blip in a news cycle is bananas. Just insane. Like, we are living in crazy town. That should basically be the only story. The only story. Now, Mike Pence doesn't want it to be the only story. He doesn't want to talk about it all the time, but like, everybody else should talk about it all the time. Seems like Biden should invite him to the DNC convention. I'm not sure he'll go, but like, man, make the outreach. This is something really to blow up.
Mike Pence won't want to go, I'm predicting, to the DNC convention.
Sure.
But would he come to lunch? I mean, at the White House?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. He was the vice president. He deserves a certain amount of respect. He ran a competent and sort of failing campaign, but a polite, you know, not a demagogic campaign. He went to Ukraine himself early on. Just say, you know, I just wanted to have Mike here to say we disagree on a million things, but I appreciate his efforts, and especially on this fundamental issue of the shape of the world, the shape of Europe, NATO, Putin. I really think we're in considerable agreement, and I really appreciate Mike being willing to speak up on that. I mean, I think that would go some way to reassuring some of these voters that we're looking at today, because there are other voters who, of course, were with Trump, not just in 2016, but in 2020.
Yeah.
Like Cassidy Hutchinson and Mike Pence, and right? Those voters who were moved by January 6th and maybe moved by Trump's current position on this largest land war in 80 years, they need to have sort of people they can look to who are sort of like themselves. Obviously, with Republican voters against Trump, we give them voters who are literally more like themselves, you know, regular voters, so to speak. But it doesn't hurt to have some people who know Trump, worked with Trump, saying, you know, you're right to have these concerns.
Yeah, well, obviously, I think that's right. I brought up before this, the Trump saying Putin can have his way. They can do whatever they want, is what he said, to the NATO allies if they don't pay their bills. And we put that to the swing voters and asked what they thought. And luckily, they took exception to the approach. Let's listen.
That's not the way to go about it publicly, you know. He could have his people that work under him, you know, negotiate tough with the ministers of the offending countries. But again, that basically, it's not a politically correct statement to make. And what I mean by that is making a statement like that gives our so-called enemies, Russians, China, the impression that there's division within NATO, which makes the West look weak.
Well, I think it's been a longstanding commitment. So I don't think it's justified as him removing us. It's just not honoring commitments that we have to the area.
With his antics from his last term and exiting the White House, I mean, I'd be fearful. I mean, I wouldn't put it past him to do something like that. He's done some other things that I don't think NATO, you know, was his best friend. They probably looked at him and said, oh, great, here's Donald Trump again. If he shows up again on their door in another term, I think they'd have some fears on how things are going to go.
You know, it struck me listening to them that this was a pretty high info group.
Yeah.
And that often happens with the Trump to Biden voters because they're the kinds of people who are thoughtful enough to change their minds about something, right? They're engaged. They're consuming information in order to make a decision and then change their minds on things. Like, it's just a little bit different than you hear with sort of the tribal partisans on either side. What's interesting is, like, they knew quite a bit about NATO. I do think that it's unusual for a voter to know an awful lot about the important role that NATO plays. To me, that is one of the scariest things about a future Trump administration is the idea of him gutting the post-World War II world order and the Western alliance via NATO. Do you think, A, he would do it? And do you think that's something people should be talking more about to try to help people understand why that would be such a disaster?
Yeah, yes, on both counts. I think it would happen, honestly. Even if he didn't do it right away, I just think the distrust of Trump would be so great that countries would start to have to watch out for themselves. If Ukraine fell, if Trump imposed some, quote, solution where they had to give up a ton of land and Russia gets to sit there and then continue, of course, to threaten and pay no price for the virtual genocidal stuff they've done. I mean, what do you think if you're in Poland or Czech Republic or the Nordic states? I think the degree we wildly underestimate how much benefit we get, how much more stable the world is, even though it's dangerous, because we have an alliance that's gone on a long time and people are really used to depending on it. And Trump being cavalier about it, I think, does a huge amount of damage, even before he actually starts changing policies. But, I mean, the day after he wins, I think the world gets much, much more dangerous. And making that point is important. Maybe it's not appropriate for Biden to make it as president, but others can make that point. That's the point that the John Boltons and Nikki Haley's can and have made in a way about why it's so dangerous for Trump to be saying the things he's saying about Russia, Putin, and NATO. And Americans, they don't know much about it, but, you know, a lot of Americans served in the military. A lot of Americans, you know, NATO was part of their life. And then, of course, in the Cold War, there was still a sense that we were the core, the anchor of the global security system. So I think it's very important. You know, one thing I was thinking about watching the voters is in 88, Reagan had had a successful second term. He was negotiating with Gorbachev and really had the sense, the hope that the Cold War would wind down, which it ended up doing pretty quickly. I remember I wasn't part of the George H.W. Bush campaign when he was vice president, but he had this dilemma, which is a little bit like Biden's, which is, do you run as things are much better? Reagan's been successful. The world's more peaceful. Reward me. I'm his vice president. Or do you say the world's still very dangerous? You need a tough guy, a guy who's got real experience in the world like me. And I was Reagan's VP and we stood up to the Soviet Union. You can't afford some governor from Massachusetts who's never done anything in foreign policy, who's a dovish McGovern type, you know, Democrat. And in fact, it was the second that was the more effective message. Bush had this famous bear in the woods ad, you know, it's still dangerous out there. You can't let out your guard. I think the Biden people, they're so inclined to want to say things are really better than you realize, you know. He needs to say a little bit, it's tough out there. And we need a serious, sober person. And maybe I look a little bit old to you guys sometimes, but I know what I'm doing and my team knows what they're doing. And here's 20 former generals who will support me, who aren't partisan, and we can't afford Trump. I think there needs to be a little more of a, you know, I don't know what the fear is the right word, but people need to be alarmed more about Trump and foreign policy and then reassured, of course, about Biden.
Yeah, alarmed. True. Okay. As rosy as a lot of this sound was from this particular group, because it was so rosy, I didn't want to sort of let us get away with just relying on this group because, you know, we have heard from some Trump to Biden voters in recent months where the sentiment was just like somewhat less encouraging. Let's listen.
When Trump was here, everybody was like, ooh, you know, he's a little unstable. Let's just not mess with him. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I just feel like he would go sit down with Putin and all of them and be like, listen, this is what we're doing. And he took charge. And I feel like it was seen more as like United States powerhouse versus like whatever we are right now, which I always say that I don't understand why we go and do all of these things. And we have like hungry kids.
And the homeless. And
that's like one thing that really bothers me. And I have a big like military family and stuff like that. But I don't understand why we extend all of this help and this millions and trillions and all of these things to all these other countries. But like, we have issues here, like big issues, like kids that are hungry and free lunch and all of these things because people are not getting what they need.
It's always been the U.S. that steps in. But I mean, you know, look at the border crisis and everybody that's coming over here. I mean, I think they should be more focused on the problems here than the problems over there.
I hate to bring this back to mental health. What I've been learning is you cannot help anybody if you don't help yourself first. So such as the United States, we have a lot of problems and issues with us alone. Why are we helping everybody? Because who's helping us? Who is helping us when we're in need?
I definitely don't agree with a lot of the funds being spent overseas. You know, our military is pretty stretched thin right now. I've, you know, been hearing things about the draft and it's just, you know, impending doom. It kind of seems like, you know, are we getting closer towards a world war?
So we're helping Ukraine, I get Russia's evil, blah, blah, blah. I mean, they're not necessarily wrong, but I mean, I think Iran's worse than Russia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So my whole problem with the Ukraine thing is, of course, I'm on board at first. So they want to keep the war within the actual country of Ukraine. And what that leads to is I remember Vietnam and Korea.
Okay, so that Chicago Council survey I mentioned also found that 57% of Americans believe it's best for the future of the United States to take an active role in world affairs. While that's obviously a majority, it is the lowest number on record since 1982. So we often hear from voters that we have enough problems in the U.S. and we shouldn't be sending, you know, so many resources abroad. How do you make the case to folks who are struggling that an active role in the world by the United States matters for our security and our place in the world?
Yeah, and it's not easy because the Cold War is much further away, and God knows the 20s and 30s are much, much further away. And what a real world in chaos without U.S. leadership and reliable U.S. support looks like is just something you read about in history books, if people read history books these days. I mean, I do think it's...
They read it on TikTok.
They do. That's reassuring. You know, I mean, where do you begin? I mean, one thing what Biden could say at some point, give a little history lesson. It's just like, you know, we were very committed to the world from 1949 to 1989, the Cold War. We spent about double of what we're spending now as percentage of GDP on defense. We obviously had massive expenditures on other things, intelligence and so forth. America got a lot richer. We had a pretty good 40 years there. You know, we had some terrible mistakes, Vietnam and stuff, but America got a lot richer. We had the civil rights movement. We had other sides of social progress as well. It's not, you don't have to do one rather than the other. And I think pushing back on that is hard. I think one big problem, and this is the price we're paying for Obama and Trump, they're not similar, except in this way. Since 2008, Americans have not heard from any president, any coherent, sustained account of why the U.S. has to do what it's doing in the world. Obama was a kind of, we begin with our problems at home, we're pulling back. Trump, in his own very different way, was a we're pulling back guy. Biden isn't, and he's at times has tried to explain that. But maybe it's hard to make up for 12 years. You know, it's a long time for people, right? If you're 35 years old, those are the two presidencies you remember sort of as an adult. And no one made the case. And also the world was tough. Iraq was tough. Afghanistan was the endless war. It wasn't obvious that we were succeeding in our international leadership, I suppose. And again, it's hard in politics, it's hard in life to explain all the disasters that aren't happening because we're doing certain things. You know, it's like going to the doctor or something. It's, yeah, if you don't do it, you really only realize that later on that it was a big mistake not to. So anyway, it's a long way of saying it's not easy. I think it's always a little uphill. In a big democracy like ours, people are always going to say, hey, shouldn't we be doing war at home? So it requires kind of constant education. And we really didn't do it for 12 years under Obama and Trump. And in that respect, Biden is a little bit more sympathetic to his task. I mean, he's climbing uphill a little bit more than, you know, at the end of the Cold War, in a way, for Reagan, Bush, it was a little more obvious what you were building on, right?
Yeah, I mean, on that point, but also the other point you were making about, Tim makes this point, our mutual friend, Tim Miller, that, look, if you're 35, or I don't know, you're just like kind of younger, because I was born in 1980. And so like my first political memories are of Reagan and the Cold War ending. And, but if you're not that age or anything younger than that, you basically remember, you know, just a bunch of failures, or you've never seen us win. You don't have that sense of how America can be sort of a righteous force for good. Anyway, I just think that's an important point. The only other point I would make kind of as we wrap is one of the things that's tough in this tribal, partisan, negative partisan environment that we're in, foreign policy, and this is where I think Joe Biden, going back to where I think he's got this opportunity, right now, the external threats are the things that has an opportunity to unite us as Americans tribally, right? And so I do think that if Biden speaking to that can be very effective, what it is that we do here, you know, there's a lot of talk about what it means to defend democracy and Trump being a threat to democracy. Like, democracy, what does that mean to anybody anymore? Like, are we telling people that America is a great democracy, that we're a great example and who we are? I mean, this point on education, and this is where it's tough that Biden is not a great communicator, because it is a moment for education about what American democracy means, why we do what we do, why it's important to support Ukraine, and then also to try to sort of unite us around some of those common ideas as Americans to some of these external threats that we face in this dangerous world. So that's my closing thought. I don't know if you have anything else to add.
I think it's an excellent thought. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt, it was 20 years after World War I, total catastrophe and disaster, that people had taken the lesson from that was do not get involved. 10 years after the Great Depression began, and we hadn't come out of it all, Franklin Roosevelt began in 1939, 38 even, giving speeches about the threats out there in the world. And he was always, look, I don't want to get us into wars, so like Biden, no boots on the ground. I'm not going to do that. But we can't turn a blind eye to it. We can't not think that it matters what's happening in Europe. And he was obviously focused particularly on Hitler and Mussolini, but other things as well, and Asia with Japan. And it took him a couple of years to really educate the American people, to get them ready for 1940, 41, for the draft, for Lend-Lease. And then obviously we got attacked and that changed everything. But it was hard. I mean, that was really uphill. The memories of World War I were very negative, and the Great Depression was, I mean, people talk about the problems today with 3.7% unemployment. How about, you know, 15 or 18% unemployment? And he did badly in the 1938 elections. So Roosevelt really shows you, I hope the Biden people, they should look at some of those speeches. And he's not warmongering, but he's being serious. And then in 1940, final point, he brings into his cabinet or sub-cabinet two Republicans, Stimson, pretty famous Wall Street lawyer type, if I got this right, and Knox, who I think he'd run as vice president against Roosevelt's ticket in 36, pretty partisan Republican. It would be as if Biden brought into his administration, like Mitt Romney, that's like one thing, but also Nikki Haley or something, you know, and gave them foreign policy positions. It was a political move. It was designed to sort of help get Republicans who were foreign policy focused, could see what was happening in Europe and Asia, to support Roosevelt. I mean, this was after 8 years of extremely partisan domestic politics on the New Deal, right, with Roosevelt. It's not totally incomparable to the current situation. And I come back to Biden could do more and his administration could do more to show, to convey the sense that we need serious leadership for a serious world. Some of that serious leadership comes from Republicans who are not Trump Republicans.
Yeah. Okay, Bill Kristol, thank you so much for joining us on the Focus Group podcast. And thanks to all of you for listening. Remember to rate and review and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And then go ahead and subscribe to us on YouTube as well. And we will see you guys next week. Bye.